yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much for hosting this this amazing workshop and school. I've learned a lot in this workshop, and also I've learned that I don't know many. I need to learn more about many topics that have been discussed. So in this talk, I want to try to make relations to various concepts that I that I've seen in these last 2 weeks, and also raise some questions about how to do things more sort of in a way that has been discussed. Right. So first of all, let me. So I'm starting off this this lecture by talking about four-dimensional n=2 n=2 theories. So these four-dimensional theories, they are related to the three-dimensional theories that have been discussed more in this workshop and in a couple of ways. So first, I would like to remind you about sort of the most basic relation between these theories, which is through compactifying. So suppose we start out with a six-dimensional n=1 super Young Mills, so that's 8 supercharges, and we dimensionally reduce this on R4 times the torus. Well, we let the torus go to zero size, then what we end up with is a four-dimensional field theory with 8 supercharges, which in the infrared limit has a vector in moduli space, which is made up of Coulomb and Higgs branches. And it's the Coulomb branch that I'm mostly interested in this talk. So this Coulomb branch for these n=2 theories is a hypercalor manifold. It's the so-called Hitchin moduli space, or the moduli space of Higgs bundles, which admits a torus vibration over a base B, and this B is really the Coulomb branch of the n=2 theory. So we could furthermore reduce this theory to three dimensions by putting this theory on R3 times S1, and in three dimensions we then get an n=4 super Young Mills theory, which in the IR is described by some sigma model. Again, into moduli space, which is made up of Coulomb and Higgs branches. Can I go to the next slide? Yes. Right, so there is another way to go down to three dimensions, which is... Was there a question or no?
Sorry, it's coming feedback from here.
I see. So there's another way to go to three dimensions, which is to reduce on R3 times the circle of a finite size R. And in that case, we end up with a 3D sigma model in the IR, which is not just the base of this Hitchin moduli space, but which is really the total space of this Hitchin moduli space. So to remind you, the Hitchin moduli space is a moduli space of solutions to a certain PDE, so which is written in red below. So it's formulated in terms of a connection on an SUK bundle, or more generally any compact Lie group, and that bundle I denote by E here. It's a bundle over a Riemann surface C. And then there is the Higgs field, which is a holomorphic one form on C. And yeah, so the Hitchin equations are given by these equations in terms of the field strengths of A and the Higgs field phi. So this moduli space is known to have a hyperkähler structure, which may be parametrized by this zeta. Zeta parameter, which is the subscript of M Hitchin above the equations. And so this, the Hitchin modular space is also dependent on this radius r of the circle that we reduce on. Next slide. Right, so in this talk, I will be mostly interested in an n equals two theory, four-dimensional n equals two theory, and a special background, not just on the flat R4 or flat Minkowski space, but rather what is called an omega background. And the way to construct this theory is to start out with a five-dimensional n equals one super Young Mills. And suppose that now I don't reduce it on just R4 times S1, but I pick an R4 bundle over S1. So I give this S1 a size beta, and the R4 I consider as a complex plane, complex surface. This bundle is parameterized by this equation, which is in green. So if I go around the circle, then I identify my coordinate C1, C2, and X5 with some rotation of C1, which is parameterized by a new complex parameter epsilon 1. And C2 I rotate by e to the power I beta epsilon 2. And so X5, I just shift by this beta. So in the limit where beta goes to zero, I end up with a four-dimensional background. And to make that background supersymmetric, I also need to perform a rotation in the R symmetry variables, which is in blue. Right to the omega background. And I can also make a gauge rotation if I go around the circle with variables A, which will play a role of the Coulomb parameters of this four-dimensional theory. So now with this setup, I can define, and this is very similar to what Andre Okunkov did in his talk, I can define an index or partition function where I just take the trace of the over the corresponding Hilbert space, and I have my weights in terms of these gauge rotations and spatial rotations and SU2I rotations. And that index reduced to four dimensions. And in four dimensions, it gives rise to a partition function, which is known as the Nekrasov instanton partition function, which will depend on these two complex variables, epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. It will depend on the gauge coupling, tau, and it will depend on these Coulomb parameters, A. And the log of this partition function, it starts off with a 1 over epsilon 1 epsilon 2, which is sort of the equivariant volume, because these rotations, they make you want to work equivariantly with respect to these C star actions. So it's equivariant volume of this R4. And then times a term which is called F0, which is known as the prepotential. You might have, I'm not quite sure whether we've seen it in a talk before, but you might be familiar with this object, and otherwise that's okay. And then there are terms less singular in epsilon one and two. Next slide. Right, so this four-dimensional theory, it has a symmetry group, as we saw. Well, sort of before, it has this this Poincaré symmetry, SU2L times SU2R, and it has this internal symmetry, SU2I, which is also in SU2. And the omega deformation, as we've defined it in the previous slide, it's compatible with a certain topological twist of this four-dimensional theory, which is known as the Donaldson twist. And so what you do to define this Donaldson twist is you introduce a new Poincaré group, which is the product of SU2 left times a new diagonal SU2, which is the product of the SU2 right, which is the diagonal, I should say, of the of the product of SU2 right and the SU2 internal. And for, well, in general, that leads to one scalar supercharge. Okay, next slide. So today I will be mostly interested in the background, where I only turn on one of these epsilon parameters, which is called the half omega background, and I'll denote it by C times C epsilon. Well, note that if you just restrict to this second factor, this originates from a three-dimensional setup where you have a C bundle really over a complex bundle over S1 beta. And so this background, this three-dimensional background, is sometimes known as spinning R2. And so in the last line of this slide, I denoted as this twisted product of C and S1, which might be familiar with if you're if you know various things about three-dimensional n equals two theories. So if I consider this four-dimensional n equals two theory in this half omega background, then it actually preserves some physical supersymmetry. So it preserves a two-dimensional, it's effectively described by an n equals 2.2 theory on this complex plane C. So at low energies, this theory, this effective two-dimensional theory, it has a description as coupling R abelian vector multiplets to an effective twisted superpotential. And as argued by Nekrasov and Chatasvili, this effective twisted superpotential, which I denote here by W tilde effective, it can be obtained from the four-dimensional Nekrasov instanton partition function Z in this limit, where you multiply the log of Z by epsilon 2 and then take the limit of epsilon 2 going to 0. Right. So note that if I want to understand this theory as a topological or holomorphic topological theory, then the Donaldson twist is not the appropriate one. Rather, what I want to do is I want to restrict my symmetries to some U1 subgroups of the SU2s, and then I want to define the twist with respect to the U1 that rotates the first plane and a diagonal of the U1 that rotates the second plane, as well as the U1 that, with the product of the U1, the internal U1. I think this is a very interesting background to study, perhaps using some holomorphic topological twist or something like that. I'm not sure exactly how it's related, how that would be related to the twist that I describe here, but I think that will be really nice to discuss later. And just as in Kevin's talk, it will be nice to try to understand local operators, boundary conditions, defects, etc., from this sort of perspective. Please correct me, but as far as I'm aware, that has not been considered before. So this talk, I want to consider this background from a slightly different perspective. And yeah, for that we go to the next slide. I want to get some more insights into what this theory computes in this background through a certain duality chain, which was, I think, first considered or first analyzed in the work of Nekrasov and Witten, where you replace this this C epsilon factor, so the omega background part, you replace it by a cigar, so you you change the metric in the way that it has a cigar shape, and so that the omega deformation really only acts near the origin of the tip of the cigar. Then it is known that we could, well, this is worked out in the work by Nekrasov and Witten, that we can undo this half omega deformation away from the origin of the cigar. It means that we need to do, we can equivalently just do a field redefinition. And that means that in the second picture, we end up with something singular going on near the tip of the cigar, but near infinity, we just have a cylinder, which now has a different radius, which is related, which is, well, basically it's scaled by a factor 1 over the length of epsilon, the norm of epsilon. If we now compactify on S1R, then what we find a three-dimensional sigma model of C times some interval with two boundaries. So it has a boundary at the tip and it has a boundary at infinity. And this is a sigma model, which we have seen before, has a target space, which is the Hitchian moduli space, where this the zeta parameter and R are related to the epsilon, to the original epsilon, in this way, zeta divided by R is equal to epsilon. So the sigma model has two boundary conditions at either end of this interval. And it has been mentioned before that the boundary condition at one of the ends, at the tip of the cigar, it should be described by the brain of Opers in this Hitchian moduli space. Whereas at infinity, we get a different boundary condition, and this different boundary condition should be specified by the vacuum that we land in, which is parameterized by U, as well as a phase theta, where theta is the argument of epsilon. So this is the only way it needs to be have these parameters in order to preserve for supercharges. So you might know that this means, well, this duality chain, this tells you that this that the boundary condition, which was sort of implicit, very implicit in this omega background, half omega background, it has now become very explicit in terms of a certain complex Lagrangian brain in this Hitchian moduli space. As Lev Rozhansky told us in his first lecture, I think, if we let this interval go to zero, then we're exactly in his setup and we get a two-dimensional sigma model into this base B of the Hitchian moduli space, which now has a superpotential. And the superpotential should be given by these two brains. It should be encoded by these two complex Lagrangian brains. It should be a generating function for the difference of these brains. So this superpotential, just as the boundary condition, it has two labels, U and theta, and it will depend. So once we have we've determined it, we can analytically continue it in epsilon, so we can make it a holomorphic function in epsilon. It will depend on tau as well as the Coulomb parameters A. Right, so next, yeah. Right, so we find that this two-dimensional n equals 2,2 theory in the infrared, it's encoded by this object, this superpotential, which depends on these two labels, U and theta. So this, of course, raises various questions. So how should I define this superpotential, at least in an explicit way? How is it related to this effective twisted superpotential, which encoded the n equals 2,2 theory in the half omega background? And can we say anything about the UV boundary conditions that correspond to these, that we would localize with respect to? So I'm going to sort of characterize this superpotential in a number of ways. So not all of this is probably chronological, but to give you sort of an insight of what this superpotential really is. So the first point is that the superpotential, it may be obtained at least in a weakly coupled region where this Nekrasov Shatasvili superpotential is known. It may be obtained as a Borel resummation of the epsilon expansion of this Nekrasov Shatasvili superpotential in the direction theta. And maybe for those of you who don't know, I haven't heard about Borel resummation, just a quick sort of description of that. So what we do is we would write down the epsilon series expansion of, say, some functions, in this case, this twisted superpotential. So it's a sum of Cn epsilon to the n. And if these coefficients Cn, if they go log n factorial, then a very useful thing to do is to consider the Borel transform, where you divide the coefficients by this n factorial, and then to Borel sum, so that means to integrate the resulting object, TF, along an array which has angle theta. And so in this W exactly satisfies these properties, so we're able to Borel resum it. And the end result, will depend on the theta, the direction in which we Borel summed. And the end result, it may be thought of as some trend series, where you not only have a series in terms of, where you not only have a power series in epsilon, but where there are also contributions which go like e to the power 1 over epsilon, minus 1 over epsilon, which correspond to, generally at least, they would correspond to non-perturbative incidents. And you might also have some log factors, which if you have incidents as well as anti-incidents, they would correspond to some interaction between those.
But is the intuition here that you expected an analytic function in theta to begin with? And the NS superpotential is just an expansion in a particular direction?
That's what it will turn out to be, yes.
There's this claim that W U theta can be obtained as a Borel resummation of the NS superpotential. I guess I'm just wondering, like, why would you expect that?
Why would you expect that? Yeah, I don't know. It turns out that it is this. And in hindsight, you might say, you do expect an analytic object, I guess, because of all the supersymmetry. You do expect, for reasons that I will say later, you might expect an object that jumps if you change theta. But also, it's known that this Nekrasov-Shatasvili expression that it has certain poles. So there have been people much earlier, like Marcos Mourinho and collaborators, who have worried about this, Yes, it means that this object is not defined for any sort of value of epsilon. Whereas in the full gauge theory, you want an object, at least you expect a non-perturbative object that describes this gauge theory to be in completely analytic object.
Thanks.
Okay, let's go to the next slide. Yeah. Right. So this Borel sum, it's integrated along a ray. But this integral might not be defined along all rays. So that is, there might be singularities of this Borel transform, and the ray cannot be taken to intersect these singularities. So it's only defined in an in the away from these critical directions. So the picture here is sort of the simplest picture that could arise, that there are some isolated rays, which I will call critical rays or critical directions, where the Borel transform is not defined. And then the resulting object will be piecewise constant in theta. So it will be constant in theta as long as you don't cross any of these critical rays. And it will jump, it will make a jump across such a critical ray. So why is this? So one of the reasons that this Borel resumed object is so nice is that these critical directions, they have a physical interpretation. So these critical directions, they correspond to the phases of some 4D BPS particles in this four-dimensional theory. That is, these four-dimensional BPS particles, they have some central charge. And if you consider the argument of this central charge, that will define a phase. And for phases for which there exists a BPS particle with that phase equal to the argument of C gamma, of this central charge C gamma, that is a critical direction of this Borel transform. So these particles, these BPS particles, and this is very helpful, I find. They may be visualized as certain special trajectories in spectral networks. So I think we've seen these spectral networks appear in the talks of Fei. We don't need to understand all about the spectral networks here. Here I'm just drawing some sort of the simplest example that you can imagine. So this network is drawn on C. It's on what is called the UV curve of the 4D of the 4D gauge theory. And this this network, it consists of trajectories that are emitted from the branch points of the covering of the spectral curve over this UV curve C. So these branch points are denoted by the orange crosses in the picture on the left and as well on the right. But let's look at the left picture at first. So the wiggly lines are the branch cuts that we've chosen. So these trajectories of the network, they are the black lines, which are emitted from these branch points. So if you have a simple branch point, there will be three of these trajectories emitted. And so if you change your phase theta, so a network is drawn for a phase theta, and if you change theta, then the network starts to deform. You get a picture of a movie of the network. And at special phases, and these are exactly the critical phases, at special phases, some of these trajectories, they start to overlap. And that's when a saddle appears. And these saddles, according to the work of Kyoto Moore and Neitzke, they correspond to 4D BPS particles. And their central charge can be obtained as well from this geometry by integrating the one form, the Cybercutting one form, or the tautological differential corresponding to this covering of the spectral curve over C. So to integrate this one form along a one cycle around these two branch points. So yeah, right. That's okay. So the superpotential in a very very natural way encodes all these 4D BTS particles. So it's a non-perturbative way description which encodes the BPS particles of the theory. Right. So what is the relation with the object that we started out with? So if this four-dimensional theory, if it has a weakly coupled description, then there is a special phase. Namely, if it has a weakly coupled description, it means it has a description as a gauge theory with a coupling parameter tau. And so in the infrared, the gauge group will break into U1 pieces. And due to the Higgs effect, there will be so-called W bosons. So these W bosons, they are visible in the IR, in the low energy limit. So this should be so, and well, these W bosons will have a central charge as well. And the argument of that central charge corresponds to a special phase, which I denote by theta Fenchel-Nielsen for a reason that might become more clear later. So these phases, for such phases, the network is very special because it includes families of compact trajectories. So one of example is shown in this picture. So what you see here is that the loops, the black loops on the right, they are both saddle trajectories. So they are both consist of two trajectories that have collapsed. And in between these loops, there is a whole family of compact trajectories. So these are the sign of the W bosons being present in the low energy gauge theory. And it turns out that you can't Borel sum exactly at this phase because it's a critical phase. But if you take some average where you limit to this value from above and below, then it turns out that object exactly gives you the Nekrasov-Shatasvili twisted superpotential of this four-dimensional theory. Right, so far we've assumed that this four-dimensional theory has a weakly coupled description. So that means that implicitly we could have chosen a certain UV boundary condition at the boundary of this omega background. So the boundary I consider as the plane C times the boundary of C epsilon. So this is really the boundary in the sense of the cigar picture. The standard boundary condition to take in that case for a weakly coupled gauge theory is a so-called standard Neumann boundary condition. So that means that the gauge field parallel to the boundary has Neumann boundary conditions and perpendicular to the boundary has Dirichlet boundary conditions. In the IR, that means that the boundary condition is not just specified by this point Q, which encodes which vacuum we're in and the phase theta, but it is also encoded by a polarization of sigma because a weakly coupled gauge theory automatically comes with a polarization, a choice of A and B cycles of the Cybercritton curve. Yeah. the corresponding complex Lagrangian then in this Hitchin-Monlies space, it can be formulated in terms of certain double complex double coordinates on this Hitchin modulus space. And so these complex double coordinates, I'll denote them by x, x gamma, so lower index gamma and upper index theta. So it turns out that for each value of theta, I can define some complex Darboux coordinates on this modulized space. And in terms of, so this is a very natural description. And in terms of these natural coordinates, so these are for general phases, generic phases, these are known as the cluster coordinates, the Fock-Kontcharov cluster coordinates. So for generic phases, this complex Lagrangian is then just given by the requirement that I set the coordinates corresponding to the B cycles equal to one. So more generally, so these coordinates, these complex Darboux coordinates, they can be obtained from the corresponding spectral network using a tool which is called abelianization, or W abelianization, where the W stands for the spectral network. I've tried to explain this this procedure of abelianization in many previous talks. So I don't want to do that here unless you ask me about it. But I want to say that this is just a very, very natural way to obtain, for instance, the Fock-Kontcharov cluster coordinates from spectral networks. And so this was first, at least the inverse of the abelianization map, non-abelianization was first first written down by Gyatso Moore and Naitzke, and then later we with NB, I've studied this in more detail in the formulation that that I will refer to in this talk. And this has been sort of set in the network, set in the language of categories by Nikita Nikolaev. Right, so as I said, so maybe one, can we go to the previous slide once more? So as I said, well, I said already that for generic phases, this gives rise to Fock-Kontcharov type coordinates, which that means coordinates which are defined from ideal triangulations of the surface C, the UV curve C. So what you will see generally for a weakly coupled theory is that the phases, the critical phases, have the shape of this diagram on the left. So that means that there is some accumulation point, which I've denoted by theta fn, and that is where all these rays accumulate. So that is the phase corresponding to the W boson. And so if you go close to that phase, then these FG coordinates, they limit in a certain way to other types of coordinates, which are known as complex Fenchel-Nielsen coordinates. Right, so the superpotential may then be obtained as well from these complex Darboux coordinates. So the way that the superpotential enters, it enters by defining some variables A in the way of this first equation. So the X AJs, we set them, at least if we, so these are coordinates, these axes, they are coordinates on the modulus space, on the Hitchin modulus space. So for general complex structure, so that means I can describe this modulus space as a modulus space of complexified flat connections. And then what I want to do, I know that this superpotential is related to the intersection of the brain of Opers and these boundary conditions which we've inserted at the other end. So that means that the superpotential should follow from evaluating these spectral coordinates, these Darboux coordinates, on this Lagrangian of Opper connections. So what I'm doing here is I'm evaluating my coordinates, my Darboux coordinates, on these Opper connections, and then I'm defining this to be equal to e to the power something proportional to coefficients a theta So these will be some, as they are defined here, they will define sort of a non-perturbative definition of Coulomb parameters, which have this subscripts theta, superscripts theta. And then if I do that, and I evaluate my B-type spectral coordinates as well on this family of opers, then I'll get something which I define. So this is how I define my superpotential. I define this object to be equal to e to the power epsilon times the derivative of this superpotential with respect to these variables aj theta. So it turns out that this is this is equivalent to what I did before. What I did before was Borel with summing along this, in this direction theta. But now I gain some more insight into what is actually going on. this way of phrasing it, it makes clear that this superpotential is really a generating function of opers. It's really generating function of the Lagrangian of opers in terms of these Darboux coordinates x, gamma, theta. And this is a statement which was made already at least at this critical phase, but not exactly in this language, by Nekrasov, Rosli, and Shadasvili. And so it was worked out in some other papers. It also relates the superpotential to a non-perturbative definition of what are known as the quantum periods. So you might remember from Bayes' talk that if you do the WKB approximation, then you get what is called a Ricotta equation, which had this solution, which I think she also denoted by an S. So the quantum periods are defined as periods where you integrate over the solution to the Ricotta equation. And this starts off as the classical periods, just the integrals over lambda, but it has epsilon corrections. And these parameters a theta, and it's dual, they are really the non-perturbative completions of these quantum periods. Let's see how far I am. So the next point is that, how do I really think of this this IR boundary condition in terms of the gauge theory? So that is, suppose, for instance, that I have some isolated critical ray and that I jump across this ray. So that means that my corresponding complex Darboux coordinates, they will change, and they will change with what is called a flip. So if you look at the corresponding network, then you'll see a change as in the middle to the right. So you'll see that what happens is that I have two branch points with three trajectories being emitted from these branch points. And then something happens with these trajectories. They move towards each other, and then they take off in different directions. And they are flipped, as in the picture to the right. So if you compute the corresponding spectral coordinates or complex Darboux coordinates, then this means that there is one coordinate which will stay the same Whereas the other coordinate, it will change. And in terms of these variables, a theta and its dual, as we've defined on the previous slide, this means that the dual variable makes a change which is equal to the logarithm of 1 minus e to the power something proportional to a theta. That means that the corresponding superpotential, it changes, and it changes with a dialogue. So this is all very nice, because that means that we can really interpret this in terms of coupling some three-dimensional theory to the boundary of this half omega background. Namely, there is this basic tetrahedron theory coming from the work of Tudor and Kayoto and Gukov. Its superpotential is exactly given by this dialogue. So it's very natural that if we couple this theory to the boundary, this tetrahedron can be seen as its boundary consists of two pieces, and these two pieces correspond to either of these two spectral networks. So one corresponds to the one on the left and one on the right. So this tetrahedron is a way to geometrically encode this flip in terms of a three-dimensional manifold. So if we couple the corresponding three-dimensional n equals to tetrahedron theory, so that the supersymmetric theory, if we couple it to the boundary, then that means that on the level of the geometry, on the level of the superpotential, it will jump by exactly this dialogue factor. So a similar thing can be said for any phase theta. So this was already worked out in a paper by Tudor, Gayotto, and Fain, where it was shown that these three-dimensional n equals two theories of type R, that they exactly provide the right boundary conditions for four-dimensional n equals two theory. So this fits in really nicely into this picture. So all of these IR boundary conditions, they can be obtained by starting from some sort of empty standard Neumann boundary condition, and then coupling some three-dimensional theory to it. So maybe one remark. For instance, one sort of simple thing that you could do at the boundary is you could change the polarization of sigma. On the level of the three-dimensional theory, this corresponds to electromagnetic duality. On the level of the superpotential, this corresponds to a generalized Legendre transformation. That this is also something that we saw featuring in Lev's talk, but I'm not sure exactly how I can fit it into this picture. So if anyone has a comment on that, that would be welcome as well. But if not, I'll just continue. So this new picture in terms of these non-perturbative quantum periods, it also means that we can extend this whole description beyond the weakly coupled region. So this definition of the superpotential as a generating function of Oppers, you may extend it to the whole Coulomb branch B. And you can even apply it to four-dimensional theories without a weakly coupled description. So the picture that forms then is that that this W, at least, well, so right. So one way to understand it is it can be understood as a solution to a certain Riemann-Hilbert problem, which is specified by BPS structured. So that means that by the structure of the four-dimensional BPS state. So I might say a little bit more about this later, but more importantly for now. So it means that the superpotential, you should really view it as a section of a certain line bundle over the modular space of flat connections. So that line bundle, it is a hyperholomorphic line bundle which has been which appeared previously in work by Andy and also in the context of NS5 brains by Alexandrov, Persson, and Pierlin. So this line bundle, it's defined by so the gluing maps of this line bundle, they so suppose they have two different cluster coordinates, so two different complex sets of complex Darboux coordinates, then on the intersection of these of the corresponding charts, the gluing function is given by this dialogue that we saw before. So in that way, you can build a line bundle, and you can see that this at least the exponent of this of the superpotential, that this is a section of that particular line bundle. So in a five-dimensional setting that was first discovered by the work that I quoted on the previous slide by Coman and Teschner and Longhi, and it has appeared in some other works as well. Right, so an example, so all of this can be made very concrete, very explicit in terms of in various examples. And one of the very interesting examples to consider is the pure SU2 theory. So the corresponding quiver just has two nodes. It's this Kronecker quiver, where one of the nodes corresponds to the monopole in the pure SU2 theory, and one corresponds to the dyon. And so this pure SU2 theory has a Coulomb branch, which is parameterized by quadratic differentials. And this Coulomb branch is split into two parts, two regions, a strongly coupled region and a weakly coupled region. So for a general point on a generic point in the weakly coupled region, as is on the right, so this point U, there is a spectrum of BPS particles whose faces are they accumulate at the imaginary axis in this diagram with phase theta fn. And if you're in the strongly coupled chamber, then there's only a finite number of BPS particles, the dyon, the monopole, and its antiparticles. So that's all encoded by this this Kronecker quiver. So the superpotential can be computed in each of these chambers and for any value of theta very explicitly. And so it will give you a section of a line bundle over the corresponding Hitchin modular space. So maybe I should say as a last thing, so the way to compute this this superpotential, it is really, to do that, it requires considering the spectral cover, the spectral covering of sigma over C and the corresponding network, and then applying an exact WKB analysis or equivalently ablinization in terms of that network. So a little bit was discussed by Faye. What this reveals to you is that these coordinates they can be expressed as ratios of Wronskians of some special solutions to the Hopper equation. I think Faye mentioned that. And so that means that you can get a very explicit form of these superpotentials in terms of these Wronskians. So maybe this is a good point to take a break, and maybe there are questions.
Yeah, that sounds great. Let's pause a bit. Are there if there are questions online, please unmute yourself. Go ahead. I do have one question that you've partially addressed. Is there, for someone who doesn't know anything about 40 gauge theory, is there a nice like geometric definition of W U theta?
Well, so I think the definition is a generating function of opers is the most geometric, you can get. But maybe I'm not.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. So really think about this brain of opers in the Hitchian modular space, and then there is this other brain which encodes the IR boundary condition at infinity. This other brain specifies, well, in terms of these, well, specifies some coordinates in which it is given by just setting x equal to 1, where x is this set of coordinates. W is really y dx. I mean, it's really given by the integral of the corresponding y coordinates, if you think about symplectic coordinates x and y.
Thanks.
Question. Could you explain the M theory origin of your setup? Because you seem to begin with n equal to 1 6 dimensional theory. So where does this come from?
So the four dimensional theories that I'm discussing, they're really of type of type S, class S type. So that means that they come from six dimensions, but that's where you compactify the six dimensional 0,2 theory along a Riemann surface C. So that's really the six dimensional origin of the four dimensional theories that I described. But then I'm introducing this extra S1 in order to rotate the background.
So my question is whether this extra S1 is a part of the Riemann surface.
No, it's not. It's not.
But then how do you get 6? So I assume that this is a stack of M5s. So you have 4 dimensions for your theory. You have 2 dimensions for the Riemann surface. And now you say that you need the 7th dimension for the circle around which you will rotate. And that circle is part of the 5-dimensional version. So how would you explain this?
That's a good question. I'm not sure whether that has an M5 brain. What you can always do is, let's think about sort of a subclass of theories. The ones with a gauge description. So suppose you consider, for instance, the pure SU2 gauge theory. That one is just defined as a 4-dimensional n equals 2 theory. Then we don't really need this sort of M theory description. So we can just lift that theory to 5 dimensions, where it becomes an n equals 1 theory, and then compactify it on a different background, the spinning background or the omega background, where I consider this R4 as being fibered over the 5-dimensional S1. So that description is a description. It's a type B.
Would it be possible that your setup comes from a stack of D6s? Then you would have your 7 dimensions.
Yeah, if you want, also, yeah, so I'm usually using the geometric engineering picture, which is formulated in type 2B, so where we don't really need to consider inserting brains. But maybe if you want to do that, then yeah, you could consider it in terms of the six brains.
So what happens in terms of 2B then?
Let's see. In terms of 2B, it's the background of the compact dimensions, which is changed, which is modified in such a way to encode the brains in other descriptions. So it means that you get this these geometries which are fibered over over a Riemann surface.
I thought you would have ALE, which is the source of the gauge group, and then I'm sorry, I'm asking very naive questions. I'm just trying to relate your story somehow to Sharon Simonson category. Uh-huh. Close to me.
I need to think about this. So in principle, we can put the M5 brain, of course, in any sort of supersymmetric background. So C times the omega background would be possible. But now you want to see how can we lift it one dimension higher.
You definitely say that you're not taking a Riemann surface with M5s wrapped around it and then twist around one of the cycles somehow of that Riemann surface.
Yeah, that's not indeed what we want to do. The S1 is really an extra circle.
Okay, sorry.
I guess you could. I think there is some work of Domenico Orlande and Susanna Refford about how to encode this omega deformation in terms of M theory. I think you have to turn on some background fluxes if you want to. If you want to see it in terms of the M5 brain.
That's right. It was some years ago. And there may be some chain of dualities that relates that to the sort of setting that Lev might want, where the twist circle is manifest.
Do you know an explicit picture at this minute,
Peter? No, I don't. I don't remember the story well enough. But you would, I guess at the very least, without the extra circle, you would hope that the omega background itself has some realization in M theory, and I think that's what Domenico
did. Yeah, but what we want to do next is lift this to five dimensions, and that I can see why Lev wants to do that. So it would be indeed nice to see that explicitly in terms of M theory as well.